Hello, everybody. This is Chris with the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. Today's episode is brought to you by Freshly.com. Quality meals delivered right to your door. Get $40 off your first 2 weeks. Go to Freshly.com. Let Freshly do the cooking for you. With Freshly, you can choose from a variety of delicious, fresh, and healthy chef-cooked meals, which are delivered right to your door. All you have to do is heat for 3 minutes, making mealtime and cleanup easier than before. You know, if your family's like mine, things get a little hectic, especially during school and sports seasons. Freshly will send you freshly cooked meals to your door, not frozen. They'll be fresh. Put them in the refrigerator, heat them up, and they are amazing. They do not taste like TV dinners. They taste like real home-cooked meals, and they're delivered directly to your door. You pick your meals from the constantly rotating weekly menu of 30-plus different gluten-free options. All of your meals are prepared and cooked by professional chefs and delivered fresh, never frozen. No shopping, no chopping, no cleanup. Freshly chefs take care of the meal prep for you, from perfecting the meals on your weekly menu to sourcing the best ingredients. And there's nothing artificial about it. They use only high-quality ingredients to make fresh meals. No artificial preservatives or colors, no added refined sugars, and no gluten. Just nutrient-rich food you can feel good about. Heat, eat, enjoy. Save an hour on dinner by heating one of their fully prepared nutritious meals in just 3 minutes. What are you going to do with all that saved time? Let them do the shopping, the prepping, and cooking for you. For customers like you, Freshly has a limited special time offer. 2 weeks of dinners cooked by their chefs for $40 off. It's normally $56.94 per week. Go to Freshly.com today. Actually, go to try.freshly.com for the special offer, limited time only. try.freshly.com. try.freshly.com. You know, some people think that I tell my story to get praise or to, you know, be on the news or be on shows like this. And you don't realize how difficult it is to become so vulnerable and to open your family up to that scrutiny. But I know how important it is, because when a news segment airs, I get hundreds and sometimes thousands of comments and messages and people who are suffering in silence, and they tell me how much inspiration they get. And so I don't want my struggles and everything that I've suffered to be in vain. Like, I really believe that God gives people struggles and trials to overcome them and then to be that hope and help to other people.
And a Safford City Council member is suspending his campaign for Congress.
A Safford City Councilman has suspended his campaign for Congress after suffering a heroin overdose.
His name is Chris Taylor. You may actually know the name very well. It's been very publicized here in the Arizona media and the Arizona press.
Chris Taylor was running for the Republican nomination to challenge Democrat Tom O'Halloran this November.
And tonight, Chris Taylor says he is seeking treatment for substance abuse.
We first met Chris Taylor in 2017 as we dug in on the opioid problem plaguing the eastern Arizona city of Safford.
In a previous campaign ad, Taylor opened up about his struggles with opioid addiction after two tours in Afghanistan.
Taylor, a veteran who fought off addiction to open his own treatment center, was poised to be the success story for Safford. But he went backwards as old demons resurfaced last week. A relapse that resulted in an overdose. In a statement to suspend his congressional campaign, Taylor was very direct, saying, quote, "I'm not going to hide from this. I'm not ashamed of what happened. I wish to sincerely apologize to the amazing people who have supported me. It's a haunting reminder of a dark past that will always be looking over the shoulder of a bright future."
All right. And we are now live. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. I'm your host, Chris Taylor. And today we're going to be doing part two of Black History is American History, and with a little special twist on it. Black military history is American military history. I'm going to highlight five of my favorite heroic stories of five Black Americans, and the just superhuman courageous service that they provided to America during different wars, and how without them, and this is not hyperbole or not exaggerating at all, without these people that I'm going to be talking about, we might not have won the war, the different wars that these people are in, and they're just so consequential in the history of America and the history of the American military. They just deserve to be highlighted. And I was going to just leave it at my first episode of the Black History is American History, but I started to think, you know, me being a veteran, a combat veteran, having known some amazing individuals of color that served in the military with me, and even in the 21st century, seeing the openly racist people around them, it's just, I can't imagine what it was like for these gentlemen that I'm going to be talking about here to endure what they endured while putting their lives on the line. And in these gentlemen's case, more than any white guy has ever done, and they were still treated with hatred simply for the color of their skin. It's disgusting. And the racism that exists today in the military, is disgusting as well. So I'm going to start here with William H. Kearny. He's the first Black soldier to earn the Medal of Honor. Of all the men who wore, and I'm reading from Military Times, of all the men who wore blue uniforms in the Civil War, none felt more keenly the purpose of his mission than the African-American soldier. Every marching step, every swing of a pick, and every round fired at Confederate enemies gave him a chance to strike a blow against slavery and prove himself equal to his white comrades. U.S. colored troops were consistently good fighters, performing well in every engagement in which they fought. Even their enemies had to grudgingly admit the fact. One Union member, William H. Kearny, transcended good to become great and was the first Black U.S. soldier to earn the Medal of Honor. On February 17, 1863, at age 23, Kearny heeded the call for African Americans to join a local militia unit, the Morgan Guards, with 45 other volunteers from his hometown of New Bedford, Massachusetts. That unit would later become Company C of the 54th Massachusetts Infantry Regiment. There was something unique about the new regiment, commanded by Colonel Robert Shaw. It was an all-Black unit, with the exception of senior officers and a few senior non-commissioned sergeants. The 54th Massachusetts was created to prove that Black men could be good soldiers. Of course they would be good soldiers. What, I mean, what kind of thinking goes into I just don't get it. Of Carney was born a slave on February 29, 1840 at Norfolk, Virginia. His father, also named William, escaped slavery, reaching freedom through the Underground Railroad. William Sr. then worked hard to buy the freedom of the rest of his family. The free and reunited family settled in New Bedford in the second half of the 1850s. Young William learned to read and write, and by age 15, he was interested in becoming a minister. He gave up his pursuit of the ministry, however, to join the army. In an 1863 edition of the abolitionist newspaper, The Liberator, Carney stated, quote, "Previous to the formation of colored troops, I had a strong inclination to prepare myself for the ministry. But then the country called for all persons. I could best serve my God, serving my country and my oppressed brothers." The sequel, in short, I enlisted for the war. That career change had momentous impact on Carney's life, as the 54th Massachusetts Regiment had a chance to prove its mettle in the July 18, 1863 Battle of Fort Wagner outside of Charleston, South Carolina. During the fight, the 54th made heroic attacks on the garrison, and Carney's bravery earned him a promotion to sergeant and the U.S. military's most prestigious award. Fort Wagner on Morris Island guarded the entrance of the harbor of Charleston. Robert Shaw and the 600 men of the 54th Massachusetts would spearhead this federal assault from a slim strip of sand on the east side of the fort, which faced the Atlantic Ocean. The 54th burrowed into a sand dune about 1,000 yards from Fort Wagner. Behind it was the 6th Connecticut. Federal land and sea artillery bombarded the fort all day long, and by nightfall, orders were passed down and the 54th stood up, dressed ranks, and attacked in two wings of five companies each. As the men advanced, they were immediately hit by a barrage of canister, musketry, and shelling from the fort. A bullet struck the 54th color sergeant. As the wounded man faltered, Carney threw down his gun, seized the flag, and moved to the front of the 54th's assaulting ranks. He soon found himself alone on the fort's wall, with bodies of dead and wounded comrades all around him. He knelt down to gather himself for action, still firmly holding the flag while bullets and shell fragments peppered the sand around him. Carney surveyed the battlefield and noticed that the other Union regiments had attacked to his right, drawing away the focal point of the rebel resistance. To the left, he saw a large force of soldiers advancing down the ramparts of the fort. At first, he thought they might be Union forces. Flashes of musketry soon doomed his hopes. The oncoming troops were Confederates. He wound the colors around the flagpole, made his way to a low protective wall, and moved along it to a ditch. When Carney had passed over the ditch on his way to the fort, it was dry, but now it was waist deep with water. He seemed to be alone, surrounded by the wreckage of his regiment. Carney wanted to help the wounded, but enemy fire pinned him down. Crouching in the water, he figured his best chance was to plot a course back to the federal lines and make a break for it. Carney rose to get a better look of the battlefield. It was a fateful move, as he later wrote, "The bullet I now carry in my body came whizzing like a mosquito, and I was shot. Not being prostrated by the shot, I continued my course, yet had not gone far before I was struck by a second shot." Despite carrying two slugs in his body, Carney kept moving forward. Shortly after being hit the second time, he saw another Union soldier coming in his direction. When they were within earshot, Carney held him, asking who he was. The Yankee replied he was in the 100th New York and asked if Carney was wounded. Carney said he had indeed been shot and then flinched as a third shot grazed his arm. The 100th soldier came to his aid and helped him move farther to the rear. "Now then," said the New York soldier, "let me take the colors and carry them for you." Carney, though, would not consent to that. No matter how battered he was, he explained that he would not be willing to give the colors to anyone who was not a member of the 54th Massachusetts. The pair struggled on. They didn't get far before yet another bullet hit Carney, grazing him in the head. Two men finally managed to stumble to their own lines. Carney was taken to the rear and turned over to the medical personnel. Throughout his ordeal, he held on to the colors. Cheers greeted him when Carney finally staggered into the ranks of the 54th. Before collapsing, he said, "Boys, the old flag never touched the ground. During the battle, Company C of the 54th Massachusetts was able to, for a short time, capture a small section of Fort Wagner. The 54th suffered 272 killed, wounded, or missing out of the 600 in battle. Colonel Shaw was among the dead. Total Union casualties were 1,515 out of about 5,000 in the assault force, while the Confederates had 174 casualties out of about 1,800 defenders. Although the Union forces were repulsed and had to lay siege to Fort Wagner, which the Confederates abandoned 2 months later, the 54th was widely hailed for its bravery. Like a pebble dropped into a puddle, the regiment's heroism had a ripple effect, spurring thousands of other black men to join the Union Army. Even Abraham Lincoln noted that the 54th's bravery at Wagner was a key development that helped secure final victory for the North. The bullet I now carry in my body came whizzing like a mosquito when I was shot. Not being prostrated by the shot, I continued my course. It had not gone far before I was struck by a second shot. William Carney recovered from the four wounds he received at Fort Wagner, and word soon spread of his unselfish actions. When Carney's commanders heard about his conduct, he was promoted to sergeant. Later in the war, the 54th fought a rearguard action while covering a retreat of the Battle of Olustee, but Sergeant Carney could not participate in the engagement due to the lingering effects of his wounds. Because of his injuries, he was discharged from the Army a little more than a year after the battle. On June 30, 1864, Carney subsequently married Susanna Williams, also of New Bedford. They had one child who later became an accomplished music teacher in the New Bedford area. In 1866, William Carney was appointed superintendent of streetlights for the city of New Bedford. He then went to California to seek his fortune, but returned to New Bedford in 1869 and took a job as a letter carrier for the Postal Service. He worked at that job for 32 years before retiring. After retirement, he was employed as a messenger at the Massachusetts State House, where in 1908 he would be fatally injured in an accident that trapped his leg in an elevator. William H. Carney's valor at Fort Wagner was honored on May 23, 1900, when he was awarded the Medal of Honor. That was almost 40 years after he so proudly served with the 54th Massachusetts Regiment. He was the first black soldier to receive the Medal of Honor. When asked about his heroic actions, he simply said, "I only did my duty." Whew. He was wounded four times, shot twice in the chest, once through the arm, and one bullet that grazed his head. And he did not let the flag, the American flag, hit the ground. In other accounts of this incident, he was nearly fatally wounded. When he got back to the medical personnel, they attempted to take the flag from him to let him rest, and he refused, wanting to hold on to it. He was holding on to the flag because he knew what it meant to free the oppressed. The fact that the oppressors were fellow Americans is repulsive. And the fact that that heritage and that those sentiments are being held on to today is disgusting. And I don't care who knows it. the Confederates lost the war, America prevailed, and that ideology of hate and racism will not and cannot be tolerated by anyone, cannot be appeased. We have to root out that evil for what it is, evil. Today I celebrate William H. Kearny, a true hero, an American hero. All right, the next individual I want to talk about is from the 1700s. His name is James Armistead Lafayette, and he was a spy. He's a patriot of the Revolutionary War. James Armistead Lafayette was born into slavery around 1760. James Armistead lived most of his life on a plantation in New Kent, Virginia. During the American Revolution, however, James received permission from his master, William Armistead, to enlist in the Marquis de Lafayette's French Allied units. Here, the army dispatched Armistead as a spy, playing the role of a runaway slave to gain access to General Cornwallis's headquarters. Because Armistead was a native Virginian with extensive knowledge of the terrain, the British received him without suspicion. As a result, Armistead accomplished what few spies could: direct access to the center of the British War Department. After successfully infiltrating British intelligence, Armistead floated freely between the British and American camps as a double agent. He relayed critical information to Lafayette and misleading intel to the enemy. Disinformation, propaganda. Oblivious to his true intentions, the British assigned Armistead to work under the notorious turncoat, Benedict Arnold. By helping Arnold maneuver his troops through Virginia, Armistead gained significant insight into the Redcoats' movements. Several of Armistead's finest acts occurred in 1781 during a critical moment in the Revolution, the Battle of Yorktown. The spy informed Lafayette and George Washington about approaching British reinforcements, which allowed the generals to devise a blockade, impeding enemy advancements. This success resulted in the final major victory for the colonists when Lord Cornwallis surrendered on October 17, 1781. Though Americans celebrated freedom throughout the United States at the end of the war, James Armistead returned to his life as a slave. His status as a spy meant that he did not benefit from the Act of 1783, which emancipated any slave soldiers that fought for the Revolution. As a result, Armistead began the process of petitioning Congress to fight for his freedom. After several years without success, Armistead received help from an old comrade in arms, the Marquis de Lafayette. Upon learning that Armistead remained enslaved, Lafayette wrote a letter to Congress on his behalf. Armistead received his manumission in 1787. Living off his annual pension fee, Armistead moved to his own 40-acre farm in Virginia, where he married, raised a family, and lived out the rest of his life as a free man. Armistead added Lafayette to his last name as a token of gratitude and a testament to the bond the former slave and French general shared. The two crossed paths again during Lafayette's grand tour of the United States in 1824, where the general picked James out of a crowd and cordially embraced him. James Armistead Lafayette died in 1832. The guy, the spy named James, didn't even have his own last name. Armistead being the last name of his slave owner, Lafayette being the last name of the French general that he endeared himself to during battle. People like James Armistead Lafayette are patriots. And they were little known stories of just how instrumental he was single-handedly helping the American Revolution succeed, helping General Washington with much needed intelligence gathered by a patriot to win the Battle of Yorktown and therefore continue on to win the war for revolution. Despite all that, afterwards, he had to return to his life as a slave. And because he was a spy, not an official soldier of the revolution, he was not able to benefit from the act that freed any African American that served as a soldier fighting for the revolution. It took an act of a historic general, Lafayette, whom he worked for and who recruited him, to write a special letter to Congress, finally giving him what he needed to be a free man. Grateful for James Armistead Lafayette, I'm so glad that he was able to have his own acreage with his family and able to live out life in peace and freedom. Today I honor James Armistead Lafayette. He's a true American patriot. All right, the next one, a little more close to home for me. I became aware of this gentleman in 2007, right after I joined the military. One person that I served with, a sergeant of mine, had been a young private under Sergeant First Class Alwyn Cash in Iraq, in the same unit. Was present that day when he did what he did. And if you don't know the story of Alwyn Cash, in 2005, he heroically saved like 6 or 7 American soldiers from a burning Bradley fighting vehicle. Him being the platoon sergeant, they struck an IED. There was the Bradley fighting vehicle caught up in flames. He was drenched in fuel. Diesel fuel drenched his whole body during the explosion, and so when the Bradley burst into flames, he was soaked from head to toe in diesel fuel, and without regard to his safety, he went and one by one saved his soldiers from the burning vehicle. And the very first time he reached into the burning flames, his whole body lit up and that fuel caught fire, and his whole body was flaming on fire. He didn't stop, drop, and roll. He didn't cower and run and stop. No, he went back 6 times to pull out his soldiers. After he pulled the last one out, he collapsed. He had 75% third-degree burns, over 75% of his body. He was alive. He was flown out. He was medevaced. He was then taken to an army hospital in Texas, and he died several days later of his wounds. He was awarded the Silver Star, and ever since that day, there has been a major advocacy, a major push, petitions, and everything else to upgrade his Valor Award to the Medal of Honor. And for you know, over 10 years, 10, 15 years, he kept, you know, it wasn't, they were not able to upgrade his Valor Award to a Medal of Honor, because though they hit an IED and they were, you know, he performed just a courageous, heroic, above and beyond the call of duty, everything that is needed for the Medal of Honor, except apparently to get the Medal of Honor, you have to be in direct combat, direct enemy engagement with an armed enemy. And so for 15 years, they did not have a missing piece of information. They thought that it was just the idea is just the Bradley was on fire, and yeah, he pulled him out and he was heroic, but they weren't under enemy assault. But new information and new proof came forward recently that there was, in fact, not only was he heroically on fire saving his men one by one, but there was a hail of gunfire hitting the ground inches from him each time. They were under direct assault by terrorists, by enemies of the United States. And so the Congress finally signed into law or passed a law that authorized the president to grant the Medal of Honor to Alwin Cash. President Trump signed the bill, but it was right around the time of the election. And so he wanted to wait until the new administration, President Trump thinking that he'd be the one to do it. But now they're just waiting for, it's all done. Apparently it's all done. So anyway, let me read this article about Alwin Cash. It says from taskandpurpose.com. A heroic soldier who gave his life saving teammates from a burning vehicle during the Iraq War has finally been authorized to receive the Medal of Honor. President Donald Trump signed H.R. 8276 into law, which authorized the president to grant the award to Army Sergeant First Class Alwin Cash by waiving a requirement it be approved within 5 years of the heroic action. Cash repeatedly entered a burning vehicle to recover soldiers wounded in a roadside bombing in Samarra, Iraq in October of 2005, despite being drenched in fuel. Now that the president has signed the bill into law, the Department of Defense can make a formal recommendation to award the Medal of Honor to Cash. He had posthumously received the Silver Star, which is the third highest valor award. Many people have argued that Cash deserved the nation's highest award from the get-go for combat bravery, including Major General Gary Brito, his former commander, who has led a campaign to upgrade Cash's award for more than a decade. You don't often find truly selfless sacrifice where someone puts his soldiers' welfare before his own, Brito told the Los Angeles Times in 2014. Sergeant Cash was horribly wounded and continued to fight to save his men. After his Bradley fighting vehicle was hit by a roadside bomb in October of 2005, Cash, soaked in fuel, escaped the gunner's hatch and then helped pull out his driver. Without regard for his personal safety, Cash then rushed to the back of the vehicle, reaching into the hot flames and starting pulling out his soldiers one by one. The flames gripped his fuel-soaked uniform. Flames quickly spread all over his body. Despite agonizing pain, Cash continued, evacuating soldiers from the Bradley, ultimately saving six men. He suffered second and third degree burns over 75% of his body and died a few weeks later at an army hospital in Texas. "Sergeant Cash saved my life," said Gary Mills, who was inside the burning Bradley. He told the Los Angeles Times in 2011, "With all the ammo inside that vehicle and all those flames, we'd have been dead in another minute." In the hospital, when Cash could speak, according to his sister, Casanelle Cash White, his first words were, "How are my boys?" In reference to his soldiers, he said, "I couldn't get to them fast enough." He just kept saying, "I'm good, I'm good. Take care of my guys." He wanted us to focus on everyone else. It was as if they were his children. In August, then Defense Secretary Mark Esper sent a letter to lawmakers stating that Cash's actions merit award of the Medal of Honor.
Marine Private First Class James Anderson Jr. He is the first Black Marine to receive the Medal of Honor. On February 28, 1967, while on patrol outside of the village of Quang Tri Province, Vietnam, Marine PFC James Anderson went above and beyond. When his Anderson's platoon was ambushed and came under heavy enemy fire, in the ensuing battle, an enemy grenade landed near Anderson and his fellow Marines. Without hesitation, Anderson pulled the grenade to his chest, curled his body around it, and absorbed the majority of the blast, giving his life to save his brothers in arms. He turned 20 years old 1 month before he died. For his heroism and selfless sacrifice, Anderson was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor on August 21st, 1968, making him the first African-American Marine to receive the nation's highest honor. The fact that Anderson was the first Black Marine to receive the award, though certainly not the first to show bravery or heroism in combat, may have been due to the military's history of racial segregation, which officially ended when all of the armed services were forced to desegregate in 1948. However, full integration and racial equality within the ranks would take much longer. Racial tensions within the military would remain high for years to come, especially during the Vietnam War, which coincided with the civil rights movements of the 1960s. At a time when race is once again at the center of the national debate and controversy, it is important to remember men like James Anderson, whose actions show that courage and sacrifice are not a matter of race, but are in fact black and white. Anderson's parents were presented the award by then Secretary of the Navy, Paul Ignatius, who was acting on behalf of the President Lyndon B. Johnson. The citation was read by then Commandant of the Marine Corps, Leonard F. Chapman. Born January 22, 1947 in Los Angeles, California, Anderson attended junior college briefly before enlisting in the Marines in 1966, according to a profile of Anderson on MarineParents.com. After completing recruit training at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego and follow-on training as a Marine Rifleman at Camp Pendleton, San Diego, Anderson was attached to 2nd Platoon, Company F, 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marines. He arrived in Vietnam December 1966 and was killed in action just 2 months later. Nearly a half century later, his legacy continues. In 1983, the U.S. Navy renamed and acquired Danish merchant ship, the Emma Maersk, in honor of Anderson, which carried equipment in support of the Marine Corps operations until 2009, when it was sold for scrapping. The James Anderson Jr. Memorial Park in Carson, California, was also named in his honor. It seems an ill-fitting way to treat the memory of a Marine who kept with the highest traditions of his service, placing the safety of his brothers above his own survival. However, his selfless example lives on to this day. In total, 89 African-American service members have been awarded the Medal of Honor, with the most recent being Henry Johnson, who posthumously received the award on June 2nd for his bravery in close quarters battle against German soldiers during World War I. According to the Congressional Medal of Honor Society, 4 other Black Marines received the award during the Vietnam War. They are PFC Oscar Austin, Sergeant Rodney Davis, PFC Robert Jenkins, and PFC Ralph Johnson. I know racism was very prevalent around the Vietnam War. The units were fully integrated, but the Black soldiers were treated much less than. I don't know if that's the case with James Anderson, but I'm sure there was at least some kind of hatefulness and racism directed toward him at some point in his service. And in the heat of battle, when he saw a grenade rolling towards his position with his brothers around him. He didn't care if they were white or black or Asian or Hispanic. He didn't care. He only cared about saving their lives. He didn't even have to question his decision. It was instinct. I'm going to dive on that grenade so that my brothers in arms can go home to their families. How is it that the military is full of these types of stories about black soldiers? And yet, even after all of this selfless, courageous actions, they are still not American enough. They are still not looked at the same way that a white soldier would be for doing something less than. This next story that I'm going to tell you highlights just how unequal the award system was in the military. Vernon Baker was a lieutenant in World War II. The actions that earned him the Medal of Honor took place in April of 1945. When was he awarded the medal? Not until January of 1997. One of the good things that President Bill Clinton did when he was president was he ordered an exhaustive review of all military files, of all different valor awards, of all different things, to find the African American soldiers that were not given the proper level of award simply because they were black. And Vernon Baker was one of those that got chosen and upgraded. Vernon Baker was born December 17, 1919 in Cheyenne, Wyoming. He was a first lieutenant in the infantry, the U.S. Army Company C of the 370th Regiment of the 92nd Infantry Division. While in Viareggio, Italy, a German mountain strong point on the high ground. This is the official citation. For conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his own life above and beyond the call of duty in action on 5 April and 6 April of 1945, Lieutenant Baker advanced at the head of his weapons platoon along with Company C's 3 rifle platoons toward their objective, Castle Aganoffi, a German mountain strong point on the high ground just east of the coastal highway and about 2 miles from the 370th Infantry Regiment's line of departure. Moving more rapidly than the rest of the company, Lieutenant Baker and about 25 men reached the south side of a draw some 250 yards from the castle. In reconnoitering or reconnaissance for a suitable position to set up a machine gun, Lieutenant Baker observed 2 cylindrical objects pointing out of a slit in a mount at the edge of a hill. Crawling up and under the opening, he stuck his M1 into the slit and emptied the clip, killing the observation post 2 occupants. Moving to another position in the same area, Lieutenant Baker stumbled upon a well-camouflaged machine gun nest, the crew of which was eating breakfast. He shot and killed both enemy soldiers. After Captain John Runyon, Company C's commander, joined the group, a German soldier appeared from the draw and hurled a grenade at which failed to explode. Lieutenant Baker shot the enemy soldier twice as he tried to flee. Lieutenant Baker then went down into the draw alone. There, he blasted open the concealed entrance to another dugout with a hand grenade, shot one German soldier who emerged after the explosion, tossed another grenade into the dugout, and entered firing his submachine gun, killing two more Germans. As Lieutenant Baker climbed back out of the draw, enemy machine gun and mortar fire began to inflict heavy casualties among the group of 25 soldiers, killing or wounding about two-thirds of them. When expected reinforcements did not arrive, Captain Runyon ordered a withdrawal in two groups. Lieutenant Baker volunteered to cover the withdrawal of the first group, which consisted of mostly walking wounded, and to remain to assist in the evacuation of the more seriously wounded. So he remained, he said he would cover their movement and he would remain back with the more seriously wounded. During the second group's withdrawal, Lieutenant Baker, supported by covering fire from one of his platoon members, destroyed two more machine gun positions previously bypassed during the assault. He did so with hand grenades. In all, Lieutenant Baker accounted for 9 dead enemy soldiers, elimination of 3 machine gun positions, an observation post, and a dugout. On the following night, Lieutenant Baker voluntarily led a battalion advance through enemy minefields and heavy fire toward the division objective. Lieutenant Baker's fighting spirit and daring leadership were an inspiration to his men and exemplify the highest traditions of military service. Vernon Baker fought in Italy, earned a Purple Heart, a Bronze Star, and the Distinguished Service Cross. In 1996, more than 50 years after the assault on Castle Agenolfi, he received a telephone call from a man working on a federal grant to reevaluate the heroism of blacks in World War II. It was during this phone call Baker learned he was to be awarded the Medal of Honor. Baker is the only living black World War II veteran to have ever earned the Medal of Honor. This is an interview excerpt from Vernon Baker. Summer of 1941, when I got tired of being a porter on the railroad and servant, I quit my job and joined the Army. It was June of 1941. About a week before we graduated, we were setting up in the stands, and our TAC officer, who was in charge of our platoon, asked, "Do any of you have any questions about why you're here in officer candidate school?" And one of the candidates stood up and said, "Yes, sir, Lieutenant, we'd like to know, why are they making so many second lieutenants?" At the time, the war was in full swing, and TAC officer gave that grin and said, "Candidate, because second lieutenants are expendable." On the boat going overseas, me as a young man, I was only 22 years old, and I became the father to my platoon. The men, we got to know each other. Most of them couldn't read or write, and I read their letters, and I wrote letters home for them, and we became quite close. So when we landed in Italy and we got ourselves together, our staging area on the west coast of the peninsula, and then we started our trek up the peninsula. And in the process, I lost some good men until we came to the day of April 5th, 1945. I'm an old soldier. I ain't supposed to be crying. It was 19 men that I left over in Italy there that couldn't be here with me today. And without them, 4 of those men, I probably wouldn't be here myself. And everybody calls me a hero, but those are the heroes. Because where were we? During that engagement, I was abandoned by my company commander, who told me that he was going back for reinforcements. While we were in the midst of a hellfire of engagement up there on the hill, and it made me all the more determined to accomplish our mission. Because at the time the army was segregated, it was thought that we weren't able to fight, that we were cowards because we were black. And then when our company commander, who abandoned us, went back and told our battalion commander not to worry about us because we were washed out or wiped away. I didn't find out this until after everything was over. And what made me really angry was the fact that nobody gave us any word of encouragement or any words of thanks. when I went back to the regimental headquarters to turn in the dog tags of the 19 men that I had left up on that hill, I was chewed out by the regimental commander, Colonel Sherman himself, because I wasn't wearing a steel helmet. That's so indicative of the military. Black or white, but wow. So he says that they were considered cowards, but it was his company commander that abandoned him. So he didn't say anything about that in the official citation, did it? I thought it was important to highlight some of these amazing men, amazing American soldiers, for the heroic actions that they took, not just in combat, but for all of these individuals, from the Revolutionary War to the Civil War to World War II to Vietnam to Iraq. You can see just how much inequality still exists. From all the way back in the Revolutionary War, James Armistead Lafayette provided an immeasurable service, heroic and patriotic. He helped win the Battle of Yorktown, went back and forth as a double agent, feeding the Brits with disinformation, reporting on their activity to General Washington and General Lafayette. He was not able to take part in the law that freed all black slaves that had fought in the Revolutionary War because he wasn't an official soldier. The horrible, horrible situation of the Civil War. The whole reason the war was there is because one side that seceded from the nation wanted to continue to enslave black men and women. Those amazing individuals of the Massachusetts 54th fought courageously. And they helped win the war, helped free the slaves. They truly freed the oppressed. Alwyn Cash, though his family says that they don't believe that the situation surrounding his Medal of Honor that has been 20 years in the making, they believe that it's not race that's involved in it. And that may be, but it seems awfully strange because I heard about this case in 2007, and that from a man that was there on the ground that witnessed this heroic action. So why wasn't he put in for the Medal of Honor from the very beginning? As I said in part one of this, 1 month out of the year is not enough to celebrate the heroic actions of black Americans. Black history is American history. Black military history is American military history. We must celebrate these amazing individuals. We must do so, not in a special month, but in the overall context. I'm proud to be an American. I'm humble to be an American. I'm grateful to be an American. I'm grateful to know of stories like these. I'm grateful to know of these amazing individuals from the first part of this to this military part. I celebrate these individuals. I fully empathize with the plight of people of color today and the gross injustices. It is a passion of mine, one of my life's mission, to highlight the injustices in the criminal justice system. That's where we need to begin. That's where we need to start, because so many of the systemic problems with race stem from how broken the criminal justice system is. And today is not really about getting into that. I just want to celebrate these heroes and what they've done for America. But I hope to very soon do another episode about how we can break this cycle. We can break this systemic racism that exists. And it starts in the criminal justice system, where therein lies not just racial problems, but big problems across the board that happen to affect Black individuals much more heavily. But the problems that exist are incompetence and too much unchecked discretion and power, and I hope to be able to bring some light to it. Thank you for listening to this special episode of the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. Remember to teach your children about Black history, to make them aware that Black history is American history, because of their history and because of their sacrifices. America is a better place. America is better when we are diverse. America's strength lies in our diversity. And that, I believe that 100%. So again, thank you for listening to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. I will catch you all later. Thank you very, very much.